Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
If you're a farmer in New York State, join the New York State Grown and Certified program to let people know your food is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we design, install, and maintain gardens in and around New York City. Today, the gardeners are planting about 1,000 bulbs.
Yes, and it's actually warm.
Yeah, it's really, really nice.
We're racing the rain, which is coming here tomorrow.
Very soon. We have about like 10 days left of work, 10 or 12 days. So We Dig Plants brings the culture to horticulture. And doing so, today's show is about the earliest form of education, food foraging. We have author Mike Krebel with us and his new book, The Scout's Guide to Wild Edibles, Learn How to Forage, Prepare, and Eat 40 Wild Foods. The book has just hit the market via Saintlands Press and will be a great winter read as preparation for spring outdoor adventures. Now, before we bring Mike on, I just wanted to do a little announcement. Last year, Alice and I went to New England Grows. It was really fun in Boston. And Alice and I are members of the Garden Writers Association, and they're having a great seminar this Friday, December 2nd, from 8:30 a.m. to 12:15 p.m. You don't have to be a member to come to the seminar. It's really, really interesting. It's called How to Grow an Online Presence That Gets Results. If you want to find out more, you can go to newenglandgrows.org, or you can go to GWA. If you go to the seminar, you get into New England Grows for free.
Wow.
All 3 days. So it's a really, really...
Then you can check out some landscaping tools.
Machinery.
Big trucks.
Yeah. So you can go to gwa.org or newenglandgrows.org and check it out and go to the seminar. I highly recommend it.
It's a fun conference.
Yeah.
In Boston.
Yeah, and so it's a nice
lobster roll.
Yes,
landscaping we can give you, trucks.
We can give you some some young men climbing trees indoors. It's really interesting, a memorable event. So anyway,
competitions with saws.
Yes, chainsaw competitions were really fun. Which brings us to back to the woods.
Back to the woods.
And our topic.
So, Mike, thank you for joining us. He's on the line. We've got some camping sound effects to aid us this afternoon.
Just put us in the mood for being
outdoors.
So
camping. When I've gone camping and backpacking, I always remember making bread in a can, really bad coffee without any milk, and macaroni and cheese over a campfire, which is all fun and amazing in a modern convenience sense. But Mike's book really teaches the user the fine art of identification and cooking, self-sustaining skills, and independence, which is basically, unfortunately, a lost art, given all the 1960s Frankenfood from NASA and the appropriated camping foods,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So long gone are the days of truly having to forage for your food. But Mike Krebel's book really brings the fun back into nature and education. So, Mike Krabbel is a member of the National Wild Foods Association Hall of Fame.
Wow, that's an interesting.
I know. He has retired from 35 years of teaching 7th grade science in Iowa and Michigan.
Bless you, Mike. I know about middle school. I'm married to a teacher. Bless your heart.
He's a naturalist and a nature center director before becoming a teacher. Mike was famous for getting kids outdoors and for teaching science research skills by experimenting with wild foods. Honors include Michigan Science Teacher of the Year, Michigan Environmental Educator of the Year, Keokuk in Iowa Teacher of the Year, and being inducted into the National Wild Foods Association Hall of Fame. He has served as vice president and newsletter editor of Iowa's Prairie States Mushroom Club and is an occasional contributor to the Iowa Outdoors magazine. He's well known in the Midwest Wild Edibles and Foragers Society, a Facebook group where he answers questions, identifies plants and mushrooms, and provides experience-based insights on harvesting, processing, preparing, and storing edible wild plants with a lifetime devotion to scouts, from Eagle Scout to Scoutmaster to leadership at the district and council levels. He also makes legendary sumac lemonade, grape popsicles, and dandelion donuts.
Mm.
So, Mike, your book, The Scout's Guide to Wild Edibles, thank you for joining us. And tell us about your history and your interest in writing this book.
Thanks, Carmen and Alice. It's a pleasure to be with you and an honor to be on your program. My history, I guess, starts with a parent that taught me that it was fun to be outdoors. And, you know, it's amazing that parents anymore just don't seem to have that love unless they've had a parent too that brought them into it.
Right.
I started out, I think, with my interest in wild foods working on camp staff at Camp Eastman. It's a Boy Scout camp, and we had a lot of fun. The kids really, really enjoyed it. At Iowa State, I went on and took courses in plant identification and in mushrooms, and from there it just grew. I began teaching and thought, well, kids would love this if we could do some experimenting while they're taking their science course.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be absolutely true. They loved experiments that they could taste and eat, and one of the challenges was to try to come up with sumac lemonade, for instance, that always would look good and would taste good. And believe it or not, it took 20 years to answer that question.
I remember sitting in poison sumac. And so sumac to me has a very negative connotation because I ended
understood.
Up, you know,
yeah.
blowing up like a grape.
Oh, that's interesting.
It is not pleasant. My mother got into it, too, with some ladies that wanted to have a fall foliage sort of thing. Sumac turns a beautiful scarlet in the fall.
Yeah,
whether
it's nice to sit in.
Whether it's edible kinds of sumac or whether it's poison sumac.
Right.
They're both very lovely. And we have no poison sumac in the state of Iowa.
Oh, lucky.
But because I lived in New York for 6 years, I'm well acquainted with poison sumac. Michigan has lots of it, too.
Well, it was in Michigan that I sat in it. I have family all over northern Michigan. So where in Michigan were you?
I was just north of Ann Arbor, a little town called Whitmore Lake. In fact, I'll be going back there later on this week to do a book signing and a program at the Northfield Township Area Library.
Uh-huh. Carmen, you were going to say something about sumac?
Oh, I was going to say I associate it with Middle Eastern food and Persian food because the powder is, and I associate that very kind of specific taste.
Mm-hmm.
It's mixed in with a lot of their kind of spice blends.
Right, because they have that spring ritual meal.
Yes,
right?
kind of a spring equinox. It's like a Persian thing.
Uh-huh.
And, you know... Well, I've never cultivated it or like use it, but I've bought it, you know, sort of pre package, so to speak, like, you know?
Right. I have gone to Eastern Market in Detroit in order to buy some of that za'atar.
Yes.
That spice, the Middle Eastern spice. And recently at the Midwest Wild Harvest Festival, I saw Lita Meredith, who's a good friend of mine and is reasonably well known in the New York City area.
Yes.
She worked at the Botanic Gardens and is now living over in Israel, but she actually put some of the Middle Eastern spice tar together and gifted that to me, and so I truly appreciate that.
Well, we have another New Yorker that we know in common, Ellen Zakos.
Ellen Zakos.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Mike, she's also a forager. She was from New York, and she is now in Santa Fe. We've had her on the show talk. She prepared some botanical cocktails with foraged. We got a little tipsy in the middle of the afternoon with
Ellen
her.
Ellen Zakos is a good friend of mine as well.
Yeah.
And, and so is Wild Man Steve Brill.
Yes.
And Wild Man showed me how to use the sumac to make a lemonade concentrate or substitute, and it is marvelous. It's just, it's so easy to do. You simply pick off some of the drupes, which are the dry seed-like berry things on the head of the red buried sumac, and rinse those repeatedly in water, rub them back and forth in water, and then when those have been used for a while, scoop them out and put more in, and it gets to be just almost like sumac. I didn't say that right. Almost like lemons. And it's wonderful. It's a great thing that you can, if it's dry, you know, the berry things can be put through the a kitchen strainer, and then you can sprinkle them on bread or chicken or whatever you want, and it's just a lovely addition.
So let's talk a little bit about kind of the history of foraging, and can you tell our listeners about Edeline Wood and Yule Gibbons?
Yes, Edeline Wood is one of the most influential people in the United States in terms of bringing Yule Gibbons, popularizing his book, Stalking the Wild Asparagus, Stalking the Healthful Herbs, and so forth. And she has contacted every governor at one time of the 48 to 50 states, depending on when she started it, and asked them what was their favorite wild food. And she grew up in West Virginia at a time during the Depression when people were scrambling just to sustain themselves.
Right.
And so from that time forward, she has seen wild foods go from survival fare to gastronomic delights that are sold, you know, are getting premium prices wherever they're sold in fancy chefs and so forth. But it's an honor to know her. She's the she helped form the Wild Foods Association and came up with the idea of National Wild Foods Hall of Fame, to which I'm honored to belong, as you mentioned. And Yule Gibbons was a good friend of hers. And actually, he was a keynoter for the first 8 years that the event that she started was held in West Virginia. And it draws people from all over the nation and up in Canada as well.
Mm-hmm.
And probably has influenced more people like myself, Sam Thayer, Lita Meredith, and many other people. I know Wild Man Steve Brill has actually keynoted there. And one time he was on his way to keynote and got lost late at night in a rental car. And West Virginia is quite mountainous.
Yeah.
And it has a lot of little roads winding around through the mountains that just take you 35 miles an hour at the most to navigate. And he was lost with his wife and his daughter, Violet, and they were supposed to show up at 8 o'clock, and they didn't come in until midnight, so I had to fill in for him.
Wow.
And be the keynoter that evening. But he did a marvelous program the following evening.
So can you tell us why there's a lot of these foraging books on the market? What I love about yours is your relationship with the scouts and the kind of pocket size of it. Can you?
Yes, I think that's a key. There aren't, I've got probably 250 edible wild plant books, guides of different kinds, and mushroom books in the library right behind my desk here. And there are very, very few field guides that could really be called field guides that you could tuck into a backpack and take on a day hike or a camping trip with you.
Right.
And so I wanted to make this kind of a small book. And so one of the things that I did was to reduce the number of wild edibles that are covered to those plants that are found coast to coast, to those plants that are better tasting than many others. In fact, it reminds me of something Ewell Gibbons wrote in his 1962 book, Stalking the Wild Asparagus. He wrote, "There are many wild plants reported in the literature to be edible that I don't like at all." So I picked 33 of the best tasting ones and seven of my favorite mushrooms that have a fairly wide distribution. And that helped me keep the book down to half an inch thick.
Yeah.
192 pages, but it's 4 5/8 inches by 7 inches by a half inch thick. And so it definitely is a field guide.
And it's so packed with really fun, useful information.
Well, yeah.
It's rich.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It is packed, and I give credit to the art director, Holly Rossborough, at St. Lynn's Press. She did a fantastic job of taking the things that I had, the photos that I'd been saving for 15 years since I began thinking about writing a book, and putting them in there in a way that looks nice and I think is very instructional.
And tell us a little bit. Here's the thing. Whenever I think of foraging, I end up getting the very last. I don't know if you've seen this movie, Into the Wild.
I have seen the movie, and I have read the book, and I edited. I have served as a technical editor now for 10 books on wild edibles, and my good friend Sam Thayer wrote a vivid chapter, you might say, in Nature's Garden. I asked him to tone it down a little bit because he thinks that it was just John Krakauer was totally wrong in what caused Chris McCandless' death. He felt that he simply didn't get enough calories.
Ah, so it
and,
wasn't that
John Krakauer thought, no, he had lots of things to eat. Well, those things wouldn't sustain a person very long at all because of the lack of calories in the food that he was eating.
Right.
And so
that's an interesting perspective.
That's good
I've
to know.
It. Sam's not too happy with the movie because he feels that a person that knows about edible wild plants and knows about nutrition should have been consulted on the movie.
Yeah, they should have because it's a haunting last scene.
Yes.
It is terrible.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And I just kind of chalked it up to, you know, maybe he didn't know enough, you know, like there he was out, like the foolishness of not being prepared in the woods. I mean, so I chalked it up to that, but I can't get that imagery out of my brain. So your book.
Understood, yeah.
So your book is extremely helpful in really identifying what you're eating, what parts to eat, what the plant is exactly versus some of the other non-edible plants. And I really appreciated that.
Well, thank you. Another point I think that's worth making is that it's an instructional guide. Processing, timing the harvest. There are little things like that that make a huge difference in the edibility of the plant and in terms of knowing how it tastes. It takes me back to my childhood when the Girl Scouts across the street said, "Mikey, Mikey, come on over. We're doing something that you might like." And in the driveway, their gravel driveway, they had a hobo stove made out of a number 10 can, and they had a little fire in there from twigs that were gathered under the trees, and they were cooking dandelion soup up on top in a tin can. And I said, "Dandelion soup? Ooh, isn't that bitter?" And they said, "Would you try it for us?" And I think they loved
the reaction
on my face.
Yeah.
But oddly enough, since then, not only did I begin doing things with dandelions with my school classes later on in life, but I was also asked by Dr. Peter Gale to help him judge the National Dandelion Cook-Off.
Wow.
It was held in Amish country in Dover, Ohio, and went on for at least 15 years or so, and would draw 3,000 people on a weekend. And I remember one year, a lady that won it had made dandelion poblano pepper soup using the leaves, and it was absolutely incredibly delicious.
That's so interesting, Mike. I grew up, my parents are from Italy. I was born in Italy, and they were always foraging, and dandelion is top of the list of things that they would forage.
Yeah.
When they moved to New York and they bought a house and their property abutted a golf course filled with dandelions, they would go and pick them.
Yeah.
And I had to discourage them. I said, "Look, Mom, this is not the wonderful fields of Italy where there isn't pesticides being." I said, please don't pick the dandelion from the golf course. Covered in
especially a golf course.
They so longed for the taste, Mike, they were willing to, and every opportunity they get. Last summer we went to Italy. My parents had plenty of land. They have big gardens. They grow all kinds of stuff. What were they doing by the side of the road? Picking wild fennel, these other greens, buckets and buckets of it, brought it back to the house, cooked it up. It was the best tasting thing I had the entire time I was there.
Mm-hmm. Well, we owe a lot to the Italians. That's for sure. I was in Italy and was amazed at the comparison with the United States, that there's many of the same things in terms of plants. But on the other hand, when you want to know how to use those plants in soul-satisfying meals, there's nothing like Italian cooking. And we actually had Italian mayor once that came to this National Dandelion Cook-Off, and she was a keynoter, and she told about growing up in Italy and told about the ways that they would eat dandelions, and it was just marvelous to listen and hear that.
Yeah. Well, we have to take a break. Hang on. We're at the halfway point.
Okay.
Stay on the line. We are going to take a break. We'll be back in a few minutes. You're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network.
And this one's called Sycamore by the Hollows. We'll be right back. New York State cares about New York's farmers. That's why we've developed the New York State Grown and Certified program. It's a seal New Yorkers can look for when they're shopping for food that comes from local farms. Customers are more likely to buy food that has the New York State Grown and Certified seal because it tells them that it comes from a farm that follows environmentally responsible, farm-safe protocols. In other words, the New York State Grown and Certified seal tells them their food is grown right here in New York State. You're a farmer with a lot to do, but the time it takes to sign up for the program is a great investment for your business because it lets shoppers know that your food meets higher standards, has passed assessments, and is produced by environmentally friendly farming practices. To learn about participating in the program, go to certified.ny.gov.
Meet me by the riverbank.
back in the woods.
Yes, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network.
From the riverbank.
Yes, I love the background sounds, Dave. It's really good. We're here with Mike Krebel, the author of The Scout's Guide to Wild Edibles. Learn how to forage, prepare, and eat 40 wild foods. So, Mike, let's jump right into some of the plants. One of the ones that was really interesting to us was cattail, tifa, which is an interesting choice. Not something that I would think would be edible at all. Tell us about what's edible about that and how to use it.
Okay. The cattail has long earned a reputation ever since Sewell Gibbons wrote about it, which he called the supermarket of the swamps because it had so many edible parts, and it was not difficult to prepare. One of the edible parts you see in the early spring, which is the pollen head up on top of the female brown part that forms the seeds, and that pollen head, when it's still sheathed, like corn on the cob is sheathed, you can peel the sheaths off, drop them in boiling water, and they look like, excuse me for this comparison, but they look like green netting needles.
Okay.
And they're maybe about the size, the diameter of a pen or pencil, and you slather a little bit of butter on them and throw a little bit of salt on them, and they're surprisingly like corn, sawdusty corn.
Okay.
You know, but they actually are pretty good, and you can strip that pollen off and use it in a variety of ways. As it further ripens, it becomes a bright yellow, and it makes your golden pancakes or muffins or whatever, and it's high in protein.
I was just going to ask that, like, what's the nutritive value of it? Okay.
Yeah. Protein and lutein, basically. The male flower spikes, of course, besides treating them like corn on the cob and using the pollen in batter, you can go down to the bottom of the plant and pull up on the plants that don't have that cattail part that's turning brown or turning yellow at the top. You just pull up on, like, you might pull up on a grass shoot, and as you pull slowly, it comes out, and it's Yule Gibbons called it Cossack asparagus, but it's basically has a white core at the bottom. If people have ever eaten a piece of grass that they pulled up and chewed on it as they walked along a trail or whatever, it is much the same. It's very tender, and you can chop it up. You can it can be eaten raw. It has carbohydrates in it for energy, and actually can be turned into a pretty good cooked vegetable. If you go down under the muck or sand, whatever the substrate is in the pond or the lake where you're gathering your cattails, it has sharply pointed lateral buds that are actually pretty good cooked up. One of my favorites. The brown hot dog part of the cattail provides a very interesting fare. You can make a mock pulled pork barbecue with it.
Yeah.
You mean with a furry brown?
With like the corn dog part.
Yeah, the brown stuff.
Yeah.
Even this time of the year, which is very strange. But if it started to go to seed and, get fluffy and have the bits of seed, the clumps of seed drifting around, it's too far gone.
Okay.
If you try to make it at that point in time, it becomes very, very fibrous. It will have a good taste to it, like you might imagine a barbecued pork on the vegan side. And the texture will be fine, but as you chew it, all of a sudden you're left with a wad of fibers in your mouth.
Oh,
and,
it's hard to break
spit
down.
Them out.
Yeah.
It's too far gone. So the cattail is surprisingly edible in many respects, and it's one of my favorite plants to experiment with.
I imagine it's kind of like seitan, right? Like that.
Yes.
Like
yes.
that sort of. Uh-huh. Yeah. It looked really fun. It looked like a great recipe. In the
yeah,
book.
I was tickled to find that, and I learned that at one of the wild food weekends that are held down in West Virginia. There's also one that's held in Wisconsin, and there's one held in North Carolina that I'm a regular attender.
How many ramps have you eaten?
Yeah.
Mike, were there things that you just, you know, after you tasted, you said, I'm never eating that again?
Yes.
Okay.
But then I have my eyes open when I go to one of these places where, you know, I never would have guessed that you could eat the brown part of cattails.
Right. Just,
wow.
You know, and but somebody experiments and comes up with a great recipe, and that's one of the joys of going where other foragers are present or of looking at every single book that comes out, eager to try to find what's your take on it? How do you do this? How do you make it into something that's absolutely delicious?
Right.
One of the plants that I that's quite common in New York as well as elsewhere is plantain.
Yes.
And it's a little spoon-shaped leaf, you know, that comes out in a rosette around this ground-hugging plant. And they're so common everywhere that once you learn what it looks like with its parallel veins, it's hard to miss. And I... I've heard that you could use it in salads, and I'm not a big fan of its bitterness. Some people like bitter things. I guess a whole salad might be
might
what
be a little
I tried
much.
Before yeah. of it. And maybe if I just put a few leaves here and there along with other wild foods like lamb's quarters or pigweed or something of that sort, amaranth, it might be tolerable. But in doing some experimenting on it this year, and I love the experimenting part of this hobby, I found that just where the leaf blade that's like a spoon joins what would be the handle, the petiole, the leaf stem, so to speak, it becomes very bitter. So if you take a pair of scissors and snip off the upper part that rounds it like the spoon, the bowl of the spoon, if you snip off that part and leave the stem part behind, it's much better. But it's still better to get them in the spring. So timing the harvest, again, is pretty important on it. And
well, I was excited.
Some people had showed me, let's toss these in a little bit of olive oil.
Oh.
And then we'll heat them in the oven, and they get crisp and like chips, and they're just delicious that way.
Well, what doesn't taste good with olive oil, right?
Yeah.
A little salt. I was excited to see Japanese knotweed on the menu, Mike.
Yeah.
Polygonum cuspidatum. If people can eat more of that, Alice and I would be so happy.
Yeah. You know, I we had that as a theme in North Carolina a year or two ago, and I dug some up. And at the end of the conference, I said, does anybody want to take this and plant it? And they looked at me like I was an alien.
Now, here's a question. Is there, this is not in the book, but since we're talking about oddities, kudzu.
Yes, kudzu, the young leaves on kudzu, you know, they're three-parted leaves. And if you take each leaflet and dip it in a what's a thin batter, Japanese batter?
Tempura? Like a tempura?
Yes, tempura.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If you tempura it and then drop it into an oil, down in North Carolina, they're using peanut oil to add a little bit of extra flavor. They're wonderful. And I actually told my nephew, who now lives in England, I said, but he was in North Carolina, and I said, David, if you would like, you know, to become a zillionaire, all you have to do is form a company that makes use of kudzu leaves.
Exactly.
And kudzu chips, turns them into kudzu chips. The flavor is fantastic.
Yeah.
And it's a good way to...
And it's an easy crop to plant.
Yeah, right.
And maybe it'll replace kale in the future, right? Kale chips?
Well,
got kudzu?
One we would have to study their nutritional value and make some points that way, I think.
Well, I love that... kind of the default for a lot of the plants was fruit leather. You know, and I have a 4.5-year-old, so my world is all about fruit leather. Like,
okay.
So it was really fun to see that there were several things that you can do with this.
And Japanese knotweed. Not only Japanese knotweed, but serviceberry or juneberry, as it's called, is just wonderful. Mulberry, I think, could be done that way too, but I have yet to try mulberry.
Yeah. Well, we've got some mulberry trees we can ship out your way if we can ever get them out of the ground.
And we actually plant a lot of serviceberry here in New York.
We do.
Because it's native.
They're a striking plant. If you're into landscaping, I know you
yes.
are.
Yeah.
And it's one that I would highly recommend. Why not have edible landscaping?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, and you can use amelanchier or berries anywhere that you would use as a blueberry. It's
yes.
not right.
Yeah,
you can eat it right off the tree.
They are so good as a thirst quencher on a hike, you know, in the mountains. They're just fabulous. So
yeah.
I love that. I used to spend some time in the Adirondacks, not so much time in Catskills because I was more in upstate New York when I was living. But
right.
Yeah, it's a wonderful edible wild plant that people ought to know.
Well, and let's talk about the ubiquitous urban lawn and the silver maple tree, right?
Okay, yeah.
And that recipe for toasted silver maple keys was so fantastic.
Yeah, a friend of mine that attends the Midwest Wild Harvest Festival actually went to a smaller weekend with me at the time that the silver maple seeds were coming down. She gathered up a big bunch and she showed us what to do. And it's quite simple. It has some resemblance in a way to the plantain, you know, and the olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
You can use the olive oil. I used peanut oil, again, to add a little bit more flavor.
Mm-hmm.
I was fixing this for a Boy Scout troop. We went out and collected at a meeting from the silver maple trees in the lawn. They were just loaded with these seeds.
Right.
They hadn't started dropping yet. Mine were green. This lady's were brown.
Uh-huh.
And Diane actually turned them, turned my interest into using them at any stage. But she actually was picking them up off the ground and then making sure that they look good.
Right, right.
And then she tossed them put them in a bowl and tossed them with a little bit of oil and spread them out and put them in the oven and toasted them for 15, 20 minutes or so until they were crisp.
I really want to try this and send them to school with my son and just watch his friends.
And the whole part of it is edible, Mike, not just the sort of seed inside the key, right?
The whole key, yeah.
The whole key is edible.
The whole thing is edible. The little part that makes it spin around as well as the seed.
Uh-huh.
And is it only silver maple or other maples that are?
I have tried sugar maple, and I thought it would be delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is it's not nearly as abundant when it comes down. And then it comes down in the late summer or fall. It doesn't come down in the spring. And summer maple is just so prolific with the seeds.
Yeah.
I think it's a great and easy to recognize wild edible that it's another one of those invasive plants in a sense, even though it's native. But it just spreads like crazy.
Right.
If a person didn't mow their lawn, for instance, and they had silver maple trees along the sidewalk, oh, my gosh.
Right. You'd have a forest within 2
years. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We've spent hours pulling those weeds, pulling the seedlings out of our clients' gardens.
Yeah.
Where they had, you know, an established silver maple that they didn't want to get rid of.
See, and you can cook them.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. It makes the work.
Speaking of that, when you do gardens, do you do more than landscape? Do you get into vegetable gardens as well?
Yeah, we do. And we're doing a lot of fruit stuff. There's a lot of small fruit hybrids now that are coming out for patios and
berries. Blueberries.
I'm going to start looking when this seed catalog start rolling in at the end of this month.
Yeah.
But one of the things I was going to mention is that one of my favorite I actually put in this book. It's called Garden Weed Pie. It's basically quiche.
Uh-huh.
And made with things like green amaranth, lamb's quarters, purslane, which uh-huh. all these things are mentioned in the book, of course, yellow wood sorrel, sheep sorrel.
Yeah.
And these are just wonderful in this marvelous pie, nutritious, and you help clean out the weeds in your garden.
Right, so. Right. We don't have that much time left, but I really want to talk about mushrooms.
Yes.
Because
everybody's always excited about mushrooms.
I love mushrooms.
Right.
Love
them. And I love the Davy Crockett quote that you use, always be
right.
sure you're
always
right.
Always be sure you're right and go ahead.
Yeah.
And, that's critical. If there are characteristics in your field guide that you're consulting, and there are 12 key characteristics, and you have 11 that match, but let's say the spore color is white and it should have been brown.
Uh-huh.
You don't have that mushroom that you're hoping it is.
Yes.
So you don't ever try to force an identification, into something that's not true. And that's basically it. It has to be every single one of the characteristics of that mushroom. There are mushrooms that have strange appearances, not regular appearances, such as sulfur shelf mushroom, or as some people call it, the chicken of the woods. It doesn't hide like morels do, mm-hmm. but it is bright orange on top and sulfur yellow on the margins and sulfur yellow underneath. And I have seen that in overlapping shelves. I have seen it in a little blurp of something that comes up out of the wood, and it doesn't look at all like overlapping shelves, but it's got that bright color, to it. And one of the best ways to be confident when you go mushroom hunting is to join a mushroom club.
Mm-hmm.
And there's 6 or 7 different mushroom clubs in New York City, the area. And so if you simply get online and Google or Bing, do a search for mushroom clubs in the New York City area or in Manhattan or wherever you happen to be,
right?
Whatever borough. You'll find one close to you, and they typically not only have programs where you can learn about mushrooms, but they have hunts where you go out, you gather mushrooms, and you learn from experts what they are. So you become confident that you're not going to poison yourself or your family.
Right. Yeah, my mother, again, they foraged a lot in Italy, and they knew.
Oh, yeah.
That was one thing that they were careful about is my grandmother would never eat a mushroom. She was just too afraid. Many other people mm-hmm. in the family ate them, and they knew where to find them, and they would go on hunts. But my grandmother, who was very cautious about what she ate, would never eat a wild collected mushroom. She just didn't completely trust.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And I think there's such a fine line between there's so much.
They are so good.
Yeah.
When they're so good.
They can really enhance a dish.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
The porcini is one of my favorites.
Oh.
When I had it for the first time in Italy, the fellow did it in wine sauce,
uh-huh.
Wine butter.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my gosh. I thought I died and gone to heaven.
I know. Hen of the woods.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Chanterelles.
Oh, well, that's my favorite.
Yeah.
We charcoal grill it and baste it with barbecue sauce.
Oh, my God.
Wow. That's an interesting.
Like
I have to try
butter.
That.
They're like butter. They are so amazing.
There's
nutty butter.
Yeah.
Right?
It's the umami taste. It's the
yes.
The fifth
exactly.
taste, right?
Umami that, Incorporated.
Yeah.
So before we leave, because we're kind of wrapping up, unfortunately, tell us about the 50-mile instruction goal and eattheweeds.com.
Ah, yeah. Okay. I had to think. Dr. Peter Gale from Cleveland, Ohio, felt that books with pictures were dangerous.
Yeah.
He said because people could not look at all the little key identification features and might mistake mushrooms, especially mushrooms, for ones that resembled the right kind of mushroom. Mm-hmm. And so he felt that the best way to learn a wild edible, whether it was a mushroom or a plant, was to have somebody who's knowledgeable go with you and point it out where it grows. Mm-hmm. You would see its actual size, you would see its habitat, and you could learn. You could hold it in your hand and turn it over and smell it and if necessary, taste it. But you would have a person that knew what it was. And so he worked hard to try to come up with a list of people in the United States from coast to coast that could do that. And he got a pretty sizable list, and he used to sell it at these dandelion cook-offs. But as time went on, people passed away, other new people came in. He finally found it kind of overwhelming, and he turned it over to Sunny Savage, who lives in Hawaii, and she was quite a wild forager here, mm-hmm. did TV shows and so forth. And she did that for many years, and she passed it on to Green Dean. Dean Jordan is his name, mm-hmm. down in Florida at eattheweeds.com. And he has on there a list of foragers. And they cover not only the United States now, but some of the provinces in Canada,
uh-huh.
and even some other countries. And New York, for instance, just a second, I actually have this here. New York has Wild Man Steve Brill.
Yes.
Rita Meredith, of course, is gone, but she comes back from time to time from Israel.
Uh-huh.
Sue Ulrich in Boonville, New York.
Uh-huh.
And Marie Viljoen in Manhattan. And there's contact information on there. They're emails right. are on there. The telephone numbers of some of them are on there, so you can get in touch with them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And that's the best way. It really is
yeah.
to just go with somebody who knows, because photos and especially stuff online, you don't know. You just don't know if you can trust the sources, and the color is different online versus, you know, in real yeah. life. Alice and I know about that very well.
Yeah.
From dealing with ornamental plants.
That's one of the intents of this instructional guide I've written, the Scout's Guide to Wild Edibles. It's not just for scouts. It's for everyone who's interested,
yeah.
from kids to grandparents to scout leaders and teachers and so forth. As a teacher, we did a lot of these things in my classes, and the kids just loved it.
Yeah.
They ate it up.
Yeah, literally. Well, thank you for joining us today. And
oh, it was my honor again. Thank you both, ladies, Carmen and Alice. This is a great show, and I'll have to tune into it a little bit more often.
Great.
And Mike, if you come to New York City, let us know,
yes.
and we can go foraging together.
Sounds like a plan. Love it.
Thank you for
one.
The work. Thank you for the work on the book. It's beautiful.
You're welcome. Okay.
So thanks for joining us on We Dig Plants. If you missed any part of the show, please note it's available via archive on the website, heritageradionetwork.com, or .org, sorry, and via podcast at iTunes and Stitcher. Please leave comments and join our Facebook page, Groundworks, Inc., We Dig Plants, and join us on Twitter, at We Dig Plants, Instagram, Groundworks Gardens NYC, and our podcast website, WeDigPlantsPodcast.com. Happy gardening.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.